You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It's Tuesday, December 19th, and we're talking Diamondbacks baseball. We bring in D-backs reporter for MLB.com, Steve Gilbert. Steve, thanks as always for taking the time. Winter meetings quiet for the D-backs, like a lot of teams. I kind of sound like a broken record saying that. But you wrote recently there were a lot of discussions at the winter meetings that could lead to bigger deals or signings. What were you alluding to when you talked about that?
Yeah, you know, Darwin, we talked to Mike Hazen towards the end of the meetings and asked him about the kind of lack of activity. And he said, you know, maybe it appeared that way in terms of actually getting deals done. But below the surface, there were a lot of discussions. They talked with a number of different teams about different ideas and parameters of deals. And they felt, you know, optimistic that something could get done. Now, a lot of times things slow down around the holidays, and Hazen was hoping to kind of keep pushing things forward and not slowing down here for the holidays. You know, they talked about some different things. I know they were approached by several teams, you know, about Zach Greinke, Brandon Drury. They've gotten a lot of calls on him. Patrick Corbin as well is another guy that you know, something could materialize with. And then he also said that they had a few offers out to some free agent relievers. I'm not sure which ones those are. That's kind of been hard to pin down, but the reliever market has been pretty hot in terms of the salary some of these guys are getting. So I'm not sure, how much the Diamondbacks are in on some of that stuff, given some of their payroll restrictions. But, those are just some of the things that I think they discussed in terms of, going forward.
You mentioned Greinke, and why would he even be someone that would be considered to be on the trade market, given the fact that he's clearly an important part of the front end of the pitching staff there? Why would he be someone that could potentially be on the move?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the reasoning, the thinking there is that, you know, he's owed a lot of money, about $33 million a year for the next several years. And that's a lot for a team that's looking at a record payroll this year of $115 million. You're talking, nearly a third of the payroll in one guy. So if they were able to deal him, that would give them some flexibility. Now, they're kind of caught in the spot there because they plan on competing in 2018. So they would want to be able to not just shed some salary, but also find a way to get back pitching, whether it's in that trade or whether it's in another trade. If they trade a starting pitcher, they've been pretty forthcoming about the fact that they're going to have to figure out a way to get one in return in some deal of some type, because they don't have a ton of starting pitching depth right now. And so they've got five guys that they're counting on heading into spring training. And if they deal one of those five, they have to, before they do that, they have to know they have a path towards getting a replacement.
And another spot on the team where they're looking to build depth is in the outfield, and J.D. Martinez. Is it safe to say that he won't be part of that outfield depth, that asking price is really just too high at this point?
Well, they're staying in touch with J.D., and you always hear the rumors that, if they move Greinke, they'll have money and they can get J.D. I just, maybe I'm missing something here, but I don't see how he fits in their payroll. You know, we're talking right now about Zach Greinke's, $33 million or whatever per year, and how that's kind of restrictive in their payroll. So if you were able to get out from underneath that, then you would turn around and commit, $25 or $30 million to J.D. Martinez, a year for the next 5 years, 6 years, whatever it is he's looking for. I just don't know that that's feasible going forward for them. Certainly, they would love to have J.D. back, but I just can't see right now how that would fit in their payroll situation.
Yeah, it certainly would be tough, and they want to expand their outfield depth, everything we read about, but one unlucky injury that is kind of a deja vu of last year, Socrates Brito reportedly fractured his right pinky finger in Winter League play. And he also, I believe, broke his ring finger last year. It was his ring finger, missing the first couple months of the season. So just bad luck there, right, for Brito and the team. He was a guy that they're relying on here moving forward.
Yeah, he was a guy they were really interested in. He's a good-looking prospect. They hope he'd be ready for spring training. They were going to have him looked at by their own doctors before being able to, give a timetable or to go into the extent of the injury. But certainly he was somebody that could be their outfield depth and still could be. But, you know, I think they would have liked him to get, you know, as many at-bats as possible during the winter league. They have to look to kind of, without J.D. Martinez, they're going to need to build some depth out there. And, you know, one of the ways and one of the possible ways they could be creative in doing so is, you know, using Chris Owings. You know, he played short, he played second. But, you know, a couple of years ago when A.J. Pollock got hurt, Chris Owings filled in very nicely for him in center field. He can play all three outfield positions, has a little bit of pop in his bat, and if he ends up being kind of like a jack-of-all-trades kind of guy, that could help out their outfield depth quite a bit.
Absolutely. The team as a whole, of course, a bounce back. Great year last season with Torrey Lovello running the show, making it to the playoffs and winning the wild card game before getting knocked off by the Dodgers there. But you had a good piece, I thought, talking about Lovello, saying that he felt like the team got their feet wet in a way and that they know what it takes. So now turning the page and going towards next year, is it the sense that, okay, we got this far, now how do we improve on that and really contend for a championship? Is that really the goal here, New Year's resolution, if you will, going into next season?
Yeah, I think for Torrey, I think the raising the standard, raising the bar, raising the expectations is something that he's probably going to focus on in the spring. This was a team that was relatively young, a team without a lot of playoff experience. So I think they got a kind of a taste of that, and he felt like it showed them the kind of intensity that they need to bring on a night-in and night-out basis. You know, guys like Jake Lamb and Owings and other guys had not ever played on that stage before. Paul Goldschmidt, you know, played on it in his rookie year back in 2011. But you know, AJ Pollock had never played in one, so there was a lot of kind of a learning curve, I think, that comes with, you know, handling the postseason. And Torrey kind of is, you know, of the mindset that now this will help them going forward. And I think one of his big messages this spring will be, okay, last year was great, made the playoffs first time since 2011. That's great, but you know, now the standard is not just to make the playoffs, but to go deeper into the playoffs.
Yeah, that culture is so important, the way the manager sets it up, and clearly Torrey's done a great job so far, and now going to that next level would certainly be the goal. As we wrap up here, Steve, just looking at, of course, it's holiday season, gift-giving time, so I would imagine the D-backs not done in the offseason, although payroll is a limitation, as you talked about with J.D. Martinez, but if the D-backs fans were getting a gift from the front office, a player, a free agent, or trade that could come in and really add to that team in their quest to be championship contenders next year, what would that gift, what would that player be? What other rumors are you hearing there?
Well, you know, obviously if they could somehow afford J.D. Martinez, I think the Diamondbacks fans would love to see him in their stocking come Christmas Day. But assuming that's probably out of the question, I think it would be probably their best move at this point is to do something to add to that bullpen and possibly also add to the catching depth that they have after losing Chris Iannetta. I think, you know, either one of those two things or both would be really a key for them. And maybe they're able to do that if they move a salary such as Patrick Corbin out of the rotation, who's going to make probably about a little more than $8 million through arbitration. So that could free up some funds for them to be able to use that to maybe get a controllable starter somewhere or to kind of build up back up their bullpen a little bit more or add depth behind the plate.
Steve, we really appreciate the time as always. Happy holidays to you. Enjoy the next few weeks, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Steve Gilbert joining us here. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras.
Just four short days away until Christmas. We're talking Giants baseball today, this Thursday, December 21st. And joining us on the phone, our good friend Chris Haft, our Giants reporter for MLB.com. And, Chris, it's been something of a slow go for the Giants in the offseason, but something finally transpired, and not just something, but a big something, as the veteran slugger Evan Longoria headed across the coast as he goes from Tampa Bay to San Francisco to take over duties as the Giants' third baseman for 2018. So when you got hold of this news, is this something you kind of saw coming? Is this something that was, you know, on the radar a little bit? Or when you heard this news, did it just completely knock you sideways? Is this just something that you didn't see coming at all?
given all those choices, well, I we certainly saw something coming as far as getting a hitter, a proven hitter, a guy of Evan Longoria's stature. His name had been mentioned specifically, but in various rumors, there were so many names that went through that rumor mill, it was tough to focus on one. But, once it happened, it all kind of made sense. It all kind of came together.
Absolutely. And so Evan Longoria on his way to San Francisco, and in return, the Rays getting three of the Giants' top 30 prospects, headlined, of course, by their number one guy, Christian Arroyo. Now, Chris, given the day and age that we live in, whenever a trade like this happens or any sort of transaction, you see immediate reaction and feedback and opinions on social media. And, of course, this deal no different. There have been some less than kind responses to this deal, as some Giants fans feel, why are we giving up some top 30 prospects for a guy who's 32 and who could still hit, but maybe on the back nine of his career? Do you kind of see those concerns, or how do you feel about this trade overall?
Oh, I see those concerns, definitely. I've got to admit, my personal feelings are mixed. I think, Evan Longoria is certainly, you would think he's capable of still helping out, but there are some things that concern me. It was great that he played so frequently last year, that he was able to stay on the field, which is a tough thing, anywhere at any time in your career. The fact that his home run numbers dropped from 36 to 20, that's kind of a big red flag right there. The Giants would certainly take the 20 home runs, that's for sure. But I don't know. With the prospects, I think Arroyo, you still know what's going to happen with those guys. But a guy like Christian Arroyo, I don't know if he was the sort of guy who you had to, brush everything aside for, like a sure thing type prospect. But with Longoria being 32, they're going to have to, almost instantly start considering alternatives in a way. In that, they're going to be they're almost an old team now, and they'll be even older, the next year and the year after that. And meanwhile, a guy who could help out Christian Arroyo is, someplace else. So I'm sure management thought this out and thought that this is almost a move for now. I mean, they feel like they still have a chance to win now, and that's fine. But over the long haul, I've got some doubts.
Yeah, and I think, a lot of fans share those doubts and those concerns with you, certainly. Are you surprised, or maybe, enlighten me here, did the Giants at least kind of kick the tires on Mike Moustakas, a guy that's, younger, has a lot more power, hit 38 home runs for the Royals, last year, in a ballpark pretty much as spacious as AT&T Park? Did they ever consider him as a fit there, or was the price tag just too high?
They might have kicked those tires, but I don't think they liked the brand name. they really wanted to stay away from players who rejected the qualifying offer, and therefore they'd have to pay more than the salary. They'd have to give up draft choices and the international fees and all that. So since Moustakas was in that group, they just didn't go down that road.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they didn't, as like you said, between the free agent dollars and between the fact that they would have given up a draft pick that maybe soured them a little bit on Moustakas, despite the
definitely.
Fact that he is younger and despite the fact
definitely.
Absolutely, and that he's got, more power at least last year than Longoria, who, like you said, his home run numbers dipped considerably, 36 in 2016 to just 20 this past season in 2017. So obviously, the Giants, after finishing dead last in home runs, and whether we like it or not, we're living in the home run ball era of Major League Baseball, and they've got a guy that is obviously a bit of a power upgrade at third base. And what other areas do you feel they need to address the power situation, and what other moves do you see them pursuing to try to, climb at least a little bit closer to that, say, 200 home run mark?
I think the one that is standing out right now is a possible acquisition, another free agent acquisition, Jay Bruce, who has been linked to the Giants at various and sundry times over the last few years, but no more so than now. So I would not be at all surprised to see him sign with the Giants at some point soon.
Yeah, he was quite a fit for the Indians in the second half of last year after coming over from Cincinnati. Really helped in the Indians' playoff push, and a guy that year in and year out, you can count on him to hit 25 to 30 home runs, and that would be a real nice fit in that Giants outfield. To that end, Chris, I know that GM Bobby Evans said that after dealing Matt Moore to the Rangers and they shed Moore's, you know, $9 million salary, he came out and said, you know, this will enable us to pursue other opportunities. So when he speaks about other opportunities in that, you know, kind of vague general sense, is he talking about Jay Bruce? Is he talking about something else? You know, where do you think he's going with this?
I think he was talking about Bruce. I think he was talking about the whole thing in general. You know, we're acquiring veteran guys who make a little more money. I mean, it kind of applied to, you know, Longoria with his annual salary and the obligation they would pick up. And it will apply to whoever, whatever free agent they pick up, because I think they're going to pick up some, you know, free agent or two, you know, whether it's Bruce or somebody else. So, yeah, they really don't want to go over the tax limit, and so they have to shed as much salary as they could.
And Matt Moore was a guy that was a candidate to be shed after just a very rough 2017. We know the stuff is there, the talent's there. You know, he had some great moments with the Giants, but those moments did not come in 2017. Maybe he rediscovers himself in Texas for 2018. Chris, as we kind of shift gears here to come down the stretch, let's get into the holiday spirit a little bit. You know, we've talked about the acquisition of Longoria and some other moves that the Giants want to make. So if you look at their holiday wish list, you know, what right now, you know, after getting Longoria, what is bumped up to the top of that wish list? What is something that they really want to get accomplished before spring training rolls around?
Well, they still have a need for a center fielder, somebody who can improve the defense just by being out there, you know, with his range, that sort of thing. The esteemed John Heyman reported that Jacoby Ellsbury might make some sense for them.
Yeah,
that certainly would make some sense for them. I mean, they want a guy who doesn't have to contribute a whole lot of offense. They, I mean, of course, that'd be a bonus, but mainly they want a guy who can go get it in center field. And I would think Ellsbury fits that category.
Yeah, and Ellsbury, he's going to be, let's face it, he's odd man out in New York. He was odd man out last year before they got Giancarlo Stanton, so he's even more of an odd man out now, and maybe that would be the perfect fit in that Giants outfield, a guy that, you know, his offensive numbers have dipped, but he can still go out there and get it as a defensive presence in center field. And, Chris, the final thing I want to ask is that, you know, you find there's always one player, sometimes more than one, that they have a rough season and they need to kind of kiss and make up with the fan base heading into a new season. So I guess if there's one guy on the Giants that has to step underneath that mistletoe and, again, kiss and make up with the Giants fan base and start fresh and wipe the slate clean, who do you think that player is right now?
I would say it's Brandon Bell. The rough year he had in 2017 was not at all his fault. I mean, he got, the poor guy got, you know, concussion symptoms, after being hit in the noggin by a curveball. And, you know, it halted a year in which he had had 18 home runs. He was certain he probably was going to lead the club in home runs. He led the club in home runs anyway, even though he missed the final 51 games. But here's a guy who probably was going to finish with 20, 25 home runs. And so, again, he did not do anything, you know, horrible. He did not underperform on purpose. He was just put in that position by circumstance. But I'm sure Giants fans would love to see him, you know, put together a full year, a healthy year under any circumstances. And then, you know, if he had that healthy year, maybe he can come through with some big numbers.
Yeah, certainly a bounce back candidate and then some for the Giants for the upcoming 2018 season. Chris Haft, great stuff as always. We appreciate the time. Want to wish you and yours a happy holiday season, and we will do it again after the turn of the new year in 2018, which is coming fast and furious. So thanks again. In the meantime, it's Matt Waymire signing off for MLB.com Extras, San Francisco Giants.
It's Wednesday, December 20th, and we're talking Padres baseball as we bring in Pods reporter for MLB.com, A.J. Cassavell. A.J., thanks as always for taking some time with us. This time of year, you know, a lot of students and colleges, universities taking their finals, but I was wondering if you could give me a midterm offseason grade for the Padres as it stands right now. No huge moves yet, but several minor moves and a trade involving Chase Headley and bring in Brian Mitchell. So what's your midterm offseason grade so far for the Padres?
So far, it's pretty much an incomplete because some of the moves they've made are kind of preceding other moves that still need to be made. Based on the moves they've made so far, I'd say maybe a solid B. But a lot of it's still to be determined. They traded for Chase Headley in part to acquire Brian Mitchell to join their rotation. But what that sets up for is they need to make another move in the infield to kind of clear room, whether that means moving Headley or Yanher Solarte or Carlos Suárez or Corey Spangenberg. That remains to be seen, but it's very much incomplete, and they've added a few pitchers, but there's still more work to do there. And so some of the moves they've made have kind of set themselves up for a busier second half of the offseason than maybe the first half was.
Well, before we get to maybe one of those big names that they could be setting up for, let's look at a couple names they did bring in. Freddie Galvis, acquired from the Phillies in a trade, figures to be the opening day shortstop. That offers some stability, right, at shortstop, where the Padres kind of have been in flux, it seems like, every year at that position, right?
Yeah, you go back the last 3 years. I think 2015, they signed Clint Barmas. He was there for a year. 2016, they signed Alexi Ramirez. He was there for a year. 2017, they signed Eric Eibar. He was there for a year. And all three of those guys were kind of toward the end of their career. What trading for Galvis does, even though he's a one-year guy too, what trading for him does is they get a guy who's still kind of in his prime. They get a guy who's a very, very good defender, which they haven't had in the last three seasons. And they have probably the most ground ball heavy rotation in baseball. And so Freddie Galvis will obviously help some of those guys. AJ Preller joked that when they acquired Galvis, that Darren Balsley, the pitching coach, was probably the happiest guy in the organization because it definitely meant some good things for his starting pitchers. Galvis is still 28, and he's still a very good defender. He brings some things offensively, good clubhouse guy. The Padres are optimistic, or at least they're still kind of sorting through the possibility of whether they could bring Freddie Galvis back after the season. Essentially, this is a one-year audition almost for the Padres to kind of see what he brings to the table, see what he brings to the clubhouse, and going forward, maybe next offseason, they look to bring him back in more of a utility role because they have some good young infield prospects coming up. But they've made it very clear that this isn't necessarily a one-year stopgap like those options were in the past.
Yeah, and as you said, definitely shores things up defensively at shortstop, which is a huge thing. And another great defensive player that's still out there and just a great all-around player that's been talked about and linked to the Padres now all offseason, Eric Hosmer. That's a big name. Would bring a lot of excitement there to San Diego in terms of the team. What's the latest on Hosmer? Could he be in a Padre uniform next year?
Right now, it seems to be moving slow, and we know how Scott Boras kind of likes to test the waters, test the whole market, let it kind of develop. So I don't foresee anything coming in the immediate future. I know the Padres they're still interested in him, and I don't know what kind of financial commitment they'd be willing to take part in. But obviously, Eric Hosmer is probably right now. Will Myers, who's the current first baseman, has the largest contract in franchise history, 6 years, $83 million. Hosmer would probably exceed that. And Myers has obviously said he's happy to move to the outfield. He's happy to play right or left field if the Padres acquire Hosmer. He's a big Eric Hosmer fan. And so there's definitely room for him. There's definitely something of a fit in the sense that he's 28 and he would mesh with the Padres' plan going forward. The question is, do they want to give that kind of financial commitment to a first baseman when they already have Will Myers and when that money could be spent elsewhere, not necessarily this offseason, but maybe entering the 2019 season when the Padres hope they start to kind of turn that corner as an organization.
Right, and obviously, as you said, Hosmer would command a lot of money there at first base as well and a little redundant in positioning. But where else could that money be spent in terms of starting pitching? I know you wrote about the need for the team to go out and get more pitching, and that's not an easy thing to do. Every team wants to go out and get more starting pitching, but Mitchell was a nice addition coming over in the trade from the Yankees, a good young pitcher. But what else is out there where they could shore up the staff?
Well, they also brought back Jordan Lyles, and they didn't really get a long look at him last season, but he's a guy who will enter the rotation as a candidate. I think the Mitchell trade is kind of telling in terms of how the Padres feel about the starting pitching market. Some of the guys that they're looking, that they're interested in bringing back, I know Jolys Chacín was one of them who recently had a deal with the Milwaukee Brewers. Some of the guys, they kind of didn't match up financially. And so what the Padres did with the Brian Mitchell trade was they essentially took on Chase Headley's salary, which was 1 year, $13 million, and now they have 4 years of what they hope is a controllable starting pitcher in Mitchell.
And so I don't think the Padres see a ton of matches right now on the starting pitching market, but they do acknowledge that they need one or two more guys. So does that mean they go the trade route? Does that mean they look into free agency for potentially a bargain-type candidate like they did with Chassin and Trevor Cahill last year? Trevor Cahill, obviously, still out there too. And so it's a question mark that I'm sure we'll have answered soon. I wouldn't be surprised if A.J. Preller kind of swung another trade, maybe one of his excess of infielders for a controllable starting pitcher, maybe a project in the same way Brian Mitchell is something of a project, someone who can kind of project or who can kind of take the next who the Padres hope can be a part of the organization for a few years. I like what the deal did in that sense and kind of how it sets them up going forward, the Brian Mitchell trade. But I think another aspect of this rotation search in the organization is they love their double-A rotation. And there's two or three guys who could make an impact later on this season. So you don't want to commit too far down the road with some of these free agent options. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of how the offseason plays out and then how the season plays out with some of the young guys.
AJ, yeah, you just led me in perfectly there with the next question transitioning into I was just reading MLB.com analyst Richard Justice. He wrote a couple days ago, I'm sure you saw it as well, about how the Padres, he kind of ranked five teams that were quietly making improvements in the offseason. He had the Padres listed as third. I mean, I don't know if it was ranked, but it was five teams listed. The Padres mm-hmm. were one of them. And he talked about how it's not just the obvious moves, the trade, bring in Mitchell, but also within the organization, some of the younger players in the minor league system. Obviously, last year, Austin Hedges, Hunter Renfro get some time, so they get some time in the big leagues. But who else is out there that maybe Justice is alluding to that could be ready to maybe even help the team and come up at some point next year?
Well, the first part of that, I think, is the fact that they have all these guys who have 1 year in the major leagues, and I think it's important to stress how valuable that is. Now they can kind of almost settle in and understand what it takes to win at the major league level. You mentioned Hedges, Margot, Hunter Renfro, Carlos Asuaje, Denelson Lamet on the mound. There's a lot of those guys coming up through the system. You've got a guy like Luis Urias who's kind of knocking on the door at second base. He doesn't really project as an opening day candidate, but he'll probably, I would guess, make his debut this season. Fernando Tatis Jr. at shortstop. They feel very confident in what they have in their infield, which is the first time they could say that in a while. That the future of the Padres infield looks pretty bright, and it looks pretty solidified too, with Will Myers at first base, assuming he stays there. And so in the rotation, I mentioned the double-A rotation, they essentially have four of their top, I believe, 13 prospects kind of lurking at double-A, they're almost nearing a chance to be in the major league rotation. And I wouldn't be surprised if those four guys, Cal Quantrill, Joey Lucchese, Eric Lauer, and Jacob Nix, if those four guys get a big league spring training invite. They're not going to make the opening day roster, but it'll be their first chance to kind of face major league hitters, see what they have, see what they need to work on, see how their stuff plays, and maybe build off of that for a debut later in the season. And the Padres, I think, really hope that that these guys are kind of the foundation of the future of their pitching staff. They've already seen their young hitters come up and kind of get acquainted with the major leagues. That was what 2017 was about. I think what 2018, particularly the second half, could be about is seeing these young pitchers come up and how they fare.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It's like it's a layered effect. It's you bring up some guys, you get them comfortable, then the next level, and then the pitchers obviously sometimes take longer to really get comfortable and find their groove, but seems like they got something good going there in San Diego right now with how they're doing it. Just to wrap up right now, when you look, obviously it's the holiday season, and Christmas gifts and all kinds of gifts being exchanged. So if Padre fans get one more gift around this time of year going into January from their front office, is there any surprise-type move that could be out there? I've seen, obviously, the Marlins making trades left and right. Could a guy like Christian Yelich even be available or to solidify the outfield even more? Is that really pushing it at this point? But what else could be out there to please the Padre fans?
Well, development of the young players, but that's a little too easy. I guess that wouldn't necessarily be a gift because that's kind of something that's already happening. The Christian Yelich is someone they've checked in on, but I'm pretty sure about 25 teams have checked in on Christian Yelich. He's a heck of a ball player. So I'll go with Christian Yelich. I think Eric Hosmer comes with some questions. Comes with questions in terms of how well he lines up with the Padres' vision. I don't think there would be a Padres fan out there who would be upset with having Christian Yelich, who's young and affordable and controllable, and a great defender, and Well, we'll go with him because he's a name that's kind of been out there in the news right now. He's I think the Padres would have to give up a lot to get him, though, and I'm not sure if they would necessarily match up on that.
Absolutely. But either way, it's an exciting time to be a Padre fan for sure with the younger players really starting to develop. AJ, happy holidays to you. Thanks always for joining us, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. AJ Cassavell joining us. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Tuesday, December 19th. We're talking some Rockies baseball. We bring in Rocks reporter for MLB.com, Thomas Harding. Thomas, you're here in studio today. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for joining us as always. Let's start off with a little midterm grade of the offseason for Colorado. A lot of students around taking finals, but for the offseason, for many of the baseball teams now, for all teams, including the Rockies, it's that midpoint of the offseason. So after the winter meetings, what grade would you give the Rockies where it stands now?
I'll tell you what, right now I'm sitting at a B with a chance for it to go into that A category because the Rockies were able to pick up a couple of relief pitchers. They really needed setup guys from the right and left. They retained Jake McGee, who had a good year last year after struggling with some injuries in 2016. And they also go out and signed Brian Shaw, who had pitched with the Indians. Very good right-handed setup man, a very durable guy, 70 or more appearances in the last five seasons. And it doesn't look like he's going to slow down when it comes to that. This guy's pitched under a lot of pressure and some deep postseason runs for the Indians.
Well, Professor Harding, there you go. I think the Rockies would enjoy that grade, and it seems pretty appropriate. They also just brought back Chris Iannetta. They brought him into the fold, the catcher. What does he do for the lineup moving forward?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, a very good leader for a young pitching staff. That's still a young staff. They threw four rookies out there last year, so going into next year, they're going to have four rookies and two third-year pitchers, so it's not exactly like an old staff. And the oldest guy is Chad Bettis, who will be 29. So you need to have somebody who's been around, caught some postseason games. Of course, Iannetta played for the Arizona Diamondbacks last year and helped them to the playoffs. And if you look at his workload the last couple of years, he's going to probably catch between 89 and 100 games, somewhere in that range. And they have a couple of younger catchers, Tony Walters, who is caught pretty well for them the last 2 years, actually. And Tom Murphy, a guy with some power. He struggled a bit last year after coming back from an injury. Those two guys, there's some opportunity for them to get their big league careers going. So I think it's a good mix. You've got a veteran leader type in Iannetta, a guy who can catch about 100 games or somewhere within that. And if you look at the history of the Rockies, rarely does a catcher go above 100 games. So it'll be part of a tandem. They didn't spend too much money on Iannetta, but by spending $8.5 million, they were able to sign those three-year, $27 million contracts for Brian Shaw and for Jake McGee.
Is there any money left over then for Greg Holland, who was a big part of the success last season? Will he be back in the fold as a closer then next year?
I'll tell you what, it's funny because the rumor mill was having it as an almost done deal during the winter meetings. Turned out neither side was that close, and both sides were saying, no, it's nowhere near that close. But if you go back and even look at last year, the Rockies' negotiations with Holland, they began sometime probably after the general manager's meetings and into the winter meetings, and they lasted through the Christmas holiday there. The Rockies feel pretty confident about Holland because he really enjoyed his time there, and one of his coaches from Kansas City is the pitching coach, Steve Foster.
Right.
And that really makes a difference to him. So he definitely enjoyed pitching in Denver, even though there were some challenges. So the Rockies have a shot there. However, they have not closed the book on trade possibilities. They still continue to talk to Wade Davis also. So if this doesn't work, the Rockies do have another place to go. It's just that Holland being familiar with the situation, you can understand why people think it's going to happen. It just hasn't happened yet. So the Rockies have to be prepared.
Yeah, to have that plan B always crucial in the offseason because you never know how things can turn very quickly. And in terms of other pieces that they might be going after, we heard rumors about maybe Carlos Santana, but he ended up going to the Phillies. So what's the next move for the Rocks in the offseason? An outfield bat, where do they go for that?
Well, it looks right now like first base. And part of it is trying to bring back Mark Reynolds, who is played very well for them the last two seasons. Last year, certainly an incredible first half. Did tail off a bit in the second. But if you bring in a right-handed hitting Mark Reynolds, you also have Ryan McMahon, who was one of the better hitters in the minor leagues last year. Got his feet wet a little bit at the major league level. If he's ready, I could see a right-left platoon type thing if they do sign Reynolds. I know that looking around, seeing the analysts online, they're kind of kicking around. What about the idea of an Adrian Gonzalez hitting from the left side?
How about that?
That could make some sense because he has played quite well at Coors Field. However, when you have a guy like McMahon who could be a star player for a few years to come, if you look at his numbers last year in AA and AAA, could he be a star player for a few years to come? Bringing in a left-handed hitting first baseman, it may not quite work as well. So if you go with Reynolds and McMahon, you could do that at first base. I'm sure they have some things out there. And, hey, they never did close the book on bringing back Carlos Gonzalez in right field. But if you look at the situation as it stands now, Mark Reynolds, if you're able to sign him, you have Ryan McMahon, who really was converted from third base. Also, Ian Desmond. Now, right now, I could see Desmond fitting in the outfield with Charlie Blackman and Gerardo Parra, and you go with it that way. But Desmond also can play first base. So there are some parts that the Rockies can move around, and they really wanted to build that roster versatility.
And, of course, it is gift-giving season, the holiday season right now, and you mentioned a lot of names right there. Is there someone outside the radar? I guess you said Adrian Gonzalez, so maybe that would be the guy outside to say, oh, maybe that would be a great gift for the Rockies fans, kind of out of nowhere. But is there another name maybe that the Rockies might go after that isn't even on the radar right now that you could say, ooh, that would be a nice fit that's out there right now, whether it's a pitcher or in the lineup?
I mean, I think that a lot of fans would love to see a veteran pitcher come in here because of the young staff. The Rockies don't want to go in that direction. But if they were to pull a surprise, I think that would be where they pull it. The other one could be a reunion with Carlos Gonzalez in right field.
Right.
A lot of fans love him. He did tail off a bit last year. There are fans who feel that they need to move on from Carlos Gonzalez, but I think that would be a gift for enough fans also.
I like that as an answer, absolutely. And then, of course, New Year's a couple weeks away, and as they go into spring training and the second half of the offseason and really ramping up for the season, obviously last year very successful for the team, exceeded a lot of people's expectations. With the moves they make, when you make a lot of bullpen moves like they have, you get the sense, ooh, yeah, we're really building even for a playoff run and trying to go even deeper than they were. Is that where the front office is at and generally the coaching staff is at in terms of, hey, we made the playoffs, now let's look at that next step going forward?
Well, if you look at the Rockies' history, the times that they have been in the playoffs, they've had one of the better bullpens in baseball every time. I mean, if you watch the postseason, you see starters don't go quite as long. Of course, this postseason, they hardly went very long at all. But starters don't go quite as long in the postseason. However, if you play 81 games in Denver, then your starter doesn't go as long for all those. So really, you're building at that point. You're building like a playoff team because that's the way you sometimes have to play in Denver. Now, they do want a little bit more out of their starters than maybe they have in the past, and certainly those young guys provided it for them. And if you have John Gray come back and pitch the way he did the second half of the year, and Tyler Anderson the way he finished up, and also the guys who were rookies, and then have a full year from Chad Bettis, you could have a very good starting rotation, and then what you're trying to do is build as much strength as you can at the back of the game. Let's say they get Holland back. Okay, you have Holland, you have Shaw from the right side, you have Jake McGee from the left, Chris Russon, he pitched the second most innings of a reliever. And then I think there are some wild cards there. Adam Ottavino was considered one of the better righties in the game until last season when he struggled. He had high walks for him and probably had some pitches that could have been called strikes, actually. Looking at the stats, he lost a lot of possible borderline pitches. And then you have Carlos Estevez and Scott Oberg, two really young pitchers that finished the year both strong. And they've taken their lumps, and they've had their ups and downs for 2 years. But if those guys become solid guys, then there are a lot of arms you can use at the end of a ballgame.
Absolutely, and it's been a tough football season for the Broncos out there, so they could use a little hope with the Rockies going into spring training. So we'll see what happens there.
Thomas, enjoy your holiday season as well. We appreciate you taking the time with us today. And what's your football team? You're not originally, right? Steelers?
Steelers, yeah, okay. Steelers, yeah.
So they'll be right there when it comes down to it.
They'll be right there. Hey, your Patriots got it done on Sunday, didn't they?
They did, but we'll be ready for the rematch, I'm sure. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us here on MLB.com Extras, and we'll talk to you again real soon. It's Tuesday, December 19th. We're talking Dodgers baseball as we bring in national reporter and columnist for MLB.com, Barry Bloom. Barry, thanks very much for taking the time here in studio today. And usually teams that come within one game of winning the World Series don't pull off blockbuster off-season trades. But that's kind of what went down as the Dodgers sent Adrian Gonzalez, Brandon McCarthy, Scott Kazmir, Charlie Culberson to the Braves for former Dodger Matt Kemp, obviously shedding salary there. What was the purpose of this move? What's your take on it?
I actually think it's amazing that they were able to get rid of all those contracts, because when I looked at it, you go, you know, Gonzalez missed most of the season with a back injury, and they really don't have any place for him anymore. Nobody knows how healthy he's going to be. And Kazmir didn't pitch the entire season, and McCarthy missed most of it. So, I mean, the fact that they would get the Braves to pick up a lot of that money in return for Matt Kemp's contract, which they're paying $4 million a year on anyway from the trade to San Diego, I think it was a masterful stroke, and it gave them some, you know, room on there on the salary threshold. It gave them some room on for growth in the future and a lot of flexibility, particularly with guys that aren't really, you know, contributors at this point.
And you mentioned the future. Is there something maybe down the line, people mention Bryce Harper, throw it out there, that could be something that is targeted based on shedding this salary now, or is that sort of reaching too far?
I don't think there's any question that, you know, teams are always looking. There's it's a, you know, multi-tiered approach for any front office at this point, where, you know, you're always looking at the coming season and seasons ahead, you know, to what you can do. And you look at the market, and certainly a market next year where Harper and Machado are going to be out there. They have money to spend, whether or not they're going to be able to coax either of those guys or any of the free agents out there into it, you know, is obviously unforeseen at this point.
The Dodgers, obviously, they have a lot of money to spend. And by shedding that salary, is it just about getting under that tax threshold? They don't have to pay as much. Is that what it's about? Or is it the owner saying, okay, I just don't want to spend as much money? What is the real purpose of that? The fans say, oh, who cares? It's not my money. So what's the deal there?
Well, it's a little complicated on the tax threshold. It's $197 million. For every cent that you spend above $197 million, you have to pay a tax. The Dodgers were at $250 million last year, so they had to pay a tax. I'm not sure how many repeater years they had, but in the repeater years, the higher you go, the more years you have, the higher the tax is.
Sounds like my credit card problem.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So essentially, you know, when you're saying that, you know, if you have, like the Yankees have been paying at a 35% tax for years because they've just repeated for 10 years.
Right.
Now, if you say we duck under 1 year, and if we go back over again, we're at like 7.5%, that's a huge difference, because you're adding $7 million, $6 million onto your payroll just in taxes as part of the deals that you're making is for free agents.
Right.
So I think that's the reason why a team like the Dodgers and a team like the Yankees want to at least duck down 1 year, so that if they go back above, they're just paying the lower tax.
That makes sense. Totally. It's the cumulative effect year after year, for sure. So play professor right now. It's midterm finals for a lot of students around, but midterm of the offseason, you're Professor Barry Bloom here talking Dodgers. And what would you give them as an offseason grade so far? I'll quickly, but they also added Tom Kohler to the mix there. What would you give them?
Well, right now I'd give them a C, but it's an ascending. It's kind of a first semester grade.
Right. There's time.
There's time. And the fact is, I think that the way the free agent market is going now, there's still a lot of big names out there. And as you get closer to spring training, there are going to be good bargains on good players. Now, whether they're going to try and flip Kemp and eat some more of that salary and do something else, I think that's a question. I'm happy for Culberson, actually, because his family's from Georgia. So,
okay.
You know, it gives him kind of like a return home. I met them during the World Series. I ran into him in a restaurant. They were sweet people. You know, so I think that's good. And he was a great ad for them. He really helped them in the NLCS. But I think, you know, with the guys that they have, they've got a strong minor league system. You know, they've got people coming. And I'm not even sure, you know, if there was an American League, a DH league, you know, Kemp would be great as the DH.
Right.
I'm not sure you want him out in left field on a regular basis anymore. So I look for them to do something. And I think there's a lot that they're going to do in January and early February before you go to spring training.
They have so many assets that they have the potential to do a lot of different things for sure. One guy that won't be coming, though, and will be joining a team right next door, the Angels, is Shohei Ohtani. Obviously, two-way prodigy, tremendous young player from all indications. How disappointed were the Dodgers, or were they prepared for that to happen where they weren't going to be able to maybe reel him in?
I think that the Dodgers probably felt that they weren't the greatest team in the mix for that. You know, Ohtani was looking for, and well stated, an organization with not a great history of Japanese involvement, you know, with players coming over from that country. And he got one in the Angels. I mean, they're the highest I think he's the highest profile Japanese player ever to play for the Angels. And he comes in where, on a pitching staff that they have, which is in total flux, he's now questionably the number one pitcher. You go to the Dodgers or the Giants, he's at best number two behind Kershaw or Bumgarner, and maybe even a few rungs below that. So, I mean, I think it was a perfect spot for Ohtani. And I think the Dodgers probably figured they weren't high on the list.
Barry Bloom, national reporter and columnist from MLB.com, joining us here. And I just wanted to follow up real quick, just your overall thoughts with Ohtani. How skeptical are you about his ability to, because there's a lot that goes on in off days with pitchers in terms of preparing for the next start. How skeptical are you about his ability to pitch well, then go in DH and contribute as a hitter while also then preparing for his next start? Or do you see them being able to do that?
Well, I'm not skeptical about it. All I'm looking at is that, you know, I'm probably one of the only national reporters in this country who's actually seen him hit and pitch.
Okay.
And interviewed him a couple of times.
Okay.
So, and I think he's an unassuming, very nice young man. But my gauge of it, having been over to Japan a number of times, is that, you know, it's pretty much double-A, triple-A hitting and double-A, triple-A pitching over there. So Ohtani comes to the major leagues, and the question is going to be, how is that going to translate on not only if he had enough as a pitcher, which he really didn't pitch much last year because of injuries. He only made five starts. It would be enough coming in just as a pitcher to establish himself against major league hitters. But on the other days, he's trying to establish himself as a major league hitter against major league pitchers. So I think there's a lot out there and a lot of time to develop this. You know, I wouldn't look at it as being something that he's going to really explode on the scene. He might be disappointing in the early going as he develops and goes around the league. And I think this is part of the way he looked at it. He could take 2 years at 23, 24 at a low salary, come over here, gauge his ability to play in the league, let everybody gauge him, and then when he goes to free agency at 25, then, you know, if everybody knows what he can do and it translates over here, then he really goes for the big bucks.
Absolutely.
So I think it'll be a huge story, and I think interesting either way. If he plays half of what I think he's going to play, he's going to be a tremendous marketing asset for the league.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, and the league can certainly use even more star power and just excitement, individual stories like that. So that'll be fun, certainly, to watch. Of course, it is gift-giving season, holiday season here, and if you mentioned the Dodgers are not done making moves, so if the fans were to receive a gift from their front office, maybe, you know, not like tube socks, but like a nice gift from their front office, what player, what free agent, what's still out there that maybe the Dodgers could do here that the fans would say, wow, okay, I'll take that gift?
You know what, I may be in a minority on this, but I don't think it would be a bad idea to bring back Yu Darvish. They only had him for a couple of months after free agency. They spent a lot of time trying to retool his mechanics during those months. It was a difficult couple of months. It really showed in the World Series, whether he was tipping his pitches or whatever he was doing. You know, but he's a huge talent. And I think he would be a great complementary part to that pitching staff.
Definitely. I think he would certainly add. And just to close out here, Barry, I saw Kobe Bryant's numbers, plural, went up the Staples Center rafters last night in L.A. Manager Dave Roberts, Kenley Jansen in attendance. We've also seen Yasiel Puig has a bit of a friendship with Kobe as well. Just your thoughts on the sort of the molding of the teams out there and the support of Kobe. And also, if Bryant came into the league at 18 years old, Puig came in a tough situation, is there any sort of mentor protege, or would you say maybe that's not a good thing?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a completely different situation. Yeah. I mean, Kobe came in as a top-ranked high school player whose father played in the NBA. He'd been around the NBA for many years, and I think he was pretty well touted. In fact, I think the Lakers traded up to get the pick so they could draft Kobe.
Yes,
so
the Hornets, yeah.
The situation with Puig was, you know, he wasn't a really – he was a great raw talent, but not even a real high-packed high school player on the island. He'd never played with the national team. So when the Dodgers signed him, they signed him off a batting practice in Mexico City after he was spirited out of the island by, you know, like nefarious forces who chased him for years for the money.
Right.
So, I mean, he came over here in the worst kind of circumstances. And anybody who – you know, really has gone through it, and at the end of your career, you know, has your number retired, they all become, whether it's Gretzky over there, whether it's all, the Dodgers only retire the numbers of their Hall of Famers. There's only one non-Hall of Famer who was retired, that's Gilliam, and that was under severe pressure from the team at the time, a player, Reggie Smith, Dusty Baker. They essentially almost threatened not to play the World Series that year if they didn't retire his number.
When was
this? Was like 1978.
Oh, okay, wow.
So
okay.
It's like they did, but generally they don't retire any numbers.
Right.
So it's even Jackie Robinson's number, because of his relationship with O'Malley, which had deteriorated to such a degree. Even his number was like retired 10 years after he was in the Hall of Fame, and it was retired right before he died.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's a big thing to retire a number in Dodger history. And I think if you look around the community in any of the other sports, having a Bryant or a Magic obviously is still part of the ownership of that team. So there are great links between the Lakers and the Dodgers. And I don't think there's any, you know, non-benefit in right. not using them.
Yeah, certainly no drawback there. Barry, great stuff. Great having you in here. National reporter and columnist for MLB.com, Barry Bloom, joining us here in studio. Barry, pleasure. Thanks for joining us here on
MLB.com.
Same to you, my friend.
Great to be here.